Hello, Radioland. You're listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. This is another episode of Darshiv, and as you can tell, it is done remotely, which is how we're going to be going this fall, bringing you some content from the archives and special collections as usual on Darshiv. This fall, we're going to be featuring clips that we have access to in the archives digital repository, featuring voices from black artists from a collection called Black Experience in the Arts. And today we're going to be listening to author and novelist Louise Merriweather from her presentation to Hale Smith's Black Experience in the Arts class of March 1972 here at the University of Connecticut. You can find this episode and its content and more on our website, archives.lib.ucon.edu. Again, we'll be featuring materials from the Black Experience in the Arts collection all semester, every Monday morning from 10 to 11 a.m. Stay safe, everybody.
Any further, Louise Merriweather.
Thank you. I hope everybody can hear me. I'll try to talk loud. The topic is The Black Writer in America, From Slavery to Black Nationalism. A college student at New York University said recently that the history of black literature is just 20 years old. He is to be forgiven for his ignorance. I too went to New York University and am a product of Northern schools. When I graduated from NYU with a bachelor's degree in English, supposedly having read the literature of the world, I had not read one piece of writing by a black person. My teacher never mentioned the name of W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the world's greatest scholars, to say nothing of Langston Hughes, James Weldon Johnson, Charles Chestnut, Frederick Douglass, Jean Toomer, Phyllis Wheatley, Sterling Brown, Anna Bontemps, etc. Neither did I hear about the exploits of Nat Turner, Gabriel Prosser, Denmark Vesey, Richard Allen, or Sojourner Truth. The only black name mentioned in those university halls were Booker T. Washington and the Peanut Man. That's Dr. George Washington Carver. I did not know then, nor yet again, when I graduated from the University of California with a master's degree in journalism, that while black people were still traversing that middle passage from Africa to slavery in the New World, other slaves in America were already writing poetry. This knowledge was a trip I had to make by myself, alone, and outside those hallowed halls of ivy, a trip I would like to share with you now. Lucy Terry, a semi-literate slave girl, wrote what may have been the first recorded poem by an American black called Bars Flight in Massachusetts in 1746. The poem itself is of importance historically, only because it was the first one ever written that we know of. The second poem, the first one published by an American slave, was written in 1760 by Jupiter Hammond. These two people were both slaves, and their poetry were written during the terms of slavery. The most popular of the slave poets, and some of you may have heard of, was Phyllis Wheatley, who had an unusual talent. She was kidnapped from Senegal when she was about seven, and she lived in the Quaker household of a family named Wheatley in Boston, and she was educated along with the Wheatley's daughter. She quickly mastered English and Latin literature and gained fame as a poet. She made a trip to England, where she was received by royalty, and later she was given her freedom. In 1829, a third poet, George Moses Horton, became the first slave to openly protest his status in print. His cry for freedom was destined to become the tradition of Black literature in the United States. Almost unbrokenly, this tradition of lament was to roll down the ages, becoming a vast reservoir of bitterness and despair. Horton published two volumes of poetry. His second volume, Naked Genius, appearing in 1865. I will read you a few stanzas from his long poem, Liberty and Slavery. Alas, and am I born for this, to wear this slavish chain, deprived of all created bliss through hardship, toil, and pain? How long have I in bondage lain and languished to be free? Alas, and must I still complain, deprived of liberty? O heaven, and is there no relief this side the silent grave to soothe the pain, to quell the grief and anguish of a slave? Horton had hopes that the money from the sale of his book would purchase his freedom, but it did not. Francis E. Harper, born in 1825, was a popular poet and lecturer who worked with the Underground Railroad. She published three volumes of poems and essays. In Bury Me in a Free Land, she cries out, "Make me a grave wherever you will, in a lowly plain or a lofty hill. Make it among the earth's humblest graves, but not in a land where men are slaves. I could not rest if around my grave I heard the steps of a trembling slave. His shadow above my silent tomb would make it a place of fearful gloom." The theme of Black writing in America was thus set. The eyes of the poet were overflowing with images of brutality, injustice, and violent death. Two other important bodies of literature were also produced during the slavery period, the petition and the slave narrative. The petitions were written by free Black men in the North, and one of the most famous is David Walker's Appeal, an indictment of slavery published in 1829. "Are we men?" the appeal asked. "Are we men? Did our Creator make us to be slaves to dust and ashes like ourselves? Are they not dying worms as well as we? America is more our country than it is the whites. The greatest riches in all America have arisen from our blood and tears, and they will drive us from our property and homes, which we have earned with our blood." Walker urged Blacks to arm themselves and resist with force the oppression of the whites. The South was thrown into an uproar. Two states promptly enacted laws prohibiting the circulation of incendiary publications and forbidding the teaching of slaves to read and write. A reward of $1,000 was placed upon Walker dead. He refused to flee from the South, and after numerous threats on his life, he was found dead in the doorway of his shop. Among the important slave narratives were those written by Frederick Douglass. Douglass was born a slave in Tuckahoe, Maryland. After an unsuccessful attempt to escape slavery, he was sent to a cruel overseer and whipped. Douglass lived to whip that same overseer and to escape to the North at the age of 17, where he became the leading Black in the abolitionist movement. Douglass wrote three autobiographies at different stages of his life, which are the most important slave narratives of their time and have genuine literary merit. The first novel published by an American Black was Clotel, or The President's Daughter, published by William Walls Brown in 1853. It was originally published in London and later in this country. Clotel revealed the widespread miscegenation in the Old South. Thomas Jefferson had long been under attack by his enemies as being the father of slave children, and Clotel was his black daughter. The second black novel was The Huts of America by Martin Delaney, published in 1859. Both Brown and Delaney squeezed novel writing into careers crowded with anti-slavery work. With the invention of the cotton gin by Eli Whitney, the need to justify slavery became very powerful. Cotton was crowned king, and a huge army of slaves was necessary to keep the king on its throne. A complete rationale for slavery was evolved in white literature, and Americans viewed their darker brothers through the eyes of white authors who consistently caricatured the black man's dialect, his laughter, his sorrow, his lifestyle, while obscuring his complexity and essential humanity. Seven general classifications of stereotypes evolved, all marked either by exaggeration or omission. First is the contented slave, happy and grateful to be a slave. Second is the wretched freedman, which goes hand in hand with the contented slave. For if the slave on the plantation is happy, it follows that the man in the North must be yearning to be back in the safety of master's plantation. Third is the comic Negro. If the black man could be shown as perpetually happy, then it follows that his status in life couldn't be but so wretched. Fourth is the brute Negro, which became very popular in antebellum days. The fifth stereotype is the tragic mulatto, which declares that white blood indicates asceticism and Negro blood unbridled lust, and with such a combination, you are definitely in trouble. Sixth is the local color Negro, which stresses the quaint, the odd, the picturesque. And seventh is the exotic primitive, the contented slave now moved to the city. Harlem cabarets replaced the plantation cabins, jazz and the blues replaced the spirituals, and of course, the exotic primitive is deliriously happy. A black writer who wished to be published and to secure an audience had to pay homage to these powerful stereotypes. He could stick with the stereotypes and work with the folk dialect tradition. He could ignore his own black experience, forget his racial heritage entirely, and write as if he were white. Or he could write for the purpose of correcting and denying the stereotypes and take the chance of going unpublished. So self-consciously, while hiding what they saw and knew to be the truth and the real meaning of their lives, some poets deliberately wrote about the higher, more lyrical side of black life for white consumption. Paul Laurence Dunbar, born in 1872, was a poet of great ability who chose the road of writing pleasant folk tales of plantation blacks acceptable to a large white reading audience with preconceived ideas of Negro characters. Dunbar wrote more poems in standard English than he did in dialect, but he was forced by the American public to write with a broken tongue. His picture of rural black life, though idyllic, is peopled with likable human beings, not with clowns. But again and again in Dunbar's work, there broke through the paradox of his life, which was killing him. Then he showed his deep concern and understanding of the more serious and troublesome aspects of black life. Here's an excerpt from one of his long poems. I know why the caged bird sings on me when his wing is bruised and his bosom sore, when he beats his bars and would be free. It is not a carol of joy or glee, but a prayer that he sends from his heart's deep core, a plea that upward to heaven he flings. I know why the caged bird sings. And there were times when Dunbar spoke from his heart, as in We Wear the Mask. We wear the mask that grins and lies, that hides our cheeks and shades our eyes, this debt we pay to human guile. With torn and bleeding hearts we smile and mouth with myriad subtleties. We smile, but O great Christ, our cries to thee arise from tortured souls. We sing, but O the clay is vile beneath our feet and long the mile. But let the world dream otherwise. We wear the mask. There was a fatal conflict in Dunbar. He tried to turn his eyes as much as possible away from that vision of horror that claimed the exclusive attention of so many black writers. He tried to communicate with his country as a man. He tried to drown the fatal conflict within him with alcohol, and he succeeded. He died at the early age of 37. After 1890, black literature concerned itself with attacks upon caste. There were stories about light-skinned Negroes who could pass for white, who were handsome and worthy and cultivated, but suffering from the stigma of being judged inferior. These stories dealt with their conflicts and torments upon leaving their work, upon leaving their race to seek acceptance in white society. Outstanding in this group of writers was Charles Chestnut, who emerged as the master of the short story as a literary form. His short stories were published in the Atlantic Monthly in 1887. The fact that Chestnut was a black man was not revealed to his readers for about 12 years. His later books, published after his race became known, suffered in sales. They were honest. They probed the problem of race and contradicted the stereotypes that supported the folk dialect tradition. By 1907, practically all of the southern states had made color caste distinctions legal. There had been race riots in New York, Georgia, Texas, and Illinois, and Booker T. Washington had been chosen by white people as the Negro leader. Booker T. Washington had risen by embracing the stereotype of the Negro as a contented peasant, a docile menial under the stern but not unkindly eyes of a white boss, a creature who knew he had a place and would certainly keep it unless he got bad notions from somewhere. Booker T. Washington was the founder of Tuskegee Institute, supported by powerful white philanthropists who were more than willing to help Booker T. realize his dream of a black university in which the practical and useful arts were to be taught. These philanthropists founded normal schools in the South and community colleges in the North. The aims of both were to train blacks to be servants and lackeys of white America. In the South, this meant education designed to produce carpenters, maids, agricultural workers, and petty businessmen. In the North, to produce nurses, aides, orderlies, clerical helpers, and lab technicians. All funds for Negro education and all avenues of communication were financed through Booker T. Washington, and his control was despotic. Black schools needing help could get it only through him. Without his support, black political action failed, and many Negro writers fell silent during this period. There were also stubborn and courageous souls abroad. There was a voice abroad, W.E.B. Du Bois. In his essays, The Soul of Black Folk, Du Bois took on Booker T. Washington, praising him for his virtues and damning him for not insisting that blacks receive the franchise, higher education, and civil rights. Du Bois, who headed the black intellectuals who rebelled against Booker T, received his PhD at Harvard University and did further study in Germany. His dissertation for the doctorate degree, The Suppression of the African Slave Trade, published in 1896, was the first scientific history of American blacks and the first series in the Harvard Historical Studies. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction is a comprehensive analysis of that period and a major historical work. He claimed it was necessary to rewrite almost all of the published American history on Reconstruction because that history had been totally falsified. In addition to his historical and sociological books, Du Bois wrote novels, pageant poems, autobiographies, articles, and essays. He died in 1960s at the age of 97, and he is an idol today, and his influence is very strongly felt. During World War I, millions of blacks left the plantations and swarmed into the small towns and cities of the South, and then to the northern industrial centers. Bereft of family life, poverty-stricken, bewildered, they move restlessly in the society, but not of it. An alien culture met their eyes at every turn, and they responded with their folk songs. These anonymous folk songs remain the most significant contributions of folk and religious music to our national culture and gave rise to the blues and jazz. We raise the wheat, they give us the corn. We bake the bread, they give us the crust. We sift the meal, they give us the husk. We peel the meat, they give us the skin, and that's the way we skin the pot. They give us the liquor and say, that's good enough. A chronic and grinding poverty set in among the lower class blacks, and futility entered the heart of the urban Negro. From the teeming city of Chicago, Fenton Johnson gives us his testimony. I am tired of work. I am tired of building up somebody else's civilization. Let us take a rest, Melissa Jane. I will go down to the Last Chance Saloon, drink a gallon or two of gin, shoot a game or two of dice, and sleep the rest of the night on one of Mike's barrels. Throw the children into the river. Civilization has given us too many. It is better to die than grow up and find out that you are colored. Pluck the stars out of the heavens. The stars mark our destiny. I am tired of civilization. And Claude McKay reaches a white hot pitch of passion with, my door is shut, your door is shut against my tightened face, and I am hard as steel with discontent, but I possess the courage and the grace to bear my anger proudly and unbent. Oh, I must search for wisdom every hour, deep in my wrathful bosom sore and raw, and find in it the superhuman power, and hold me to the letter of your law. Oh, I must keep my heart inviolate against the potent poison of your hate. And County Cullen wrote, all day long and all night through, one thing only must I do, quench my pride and cool my blood, lest I perish in the flood. During World War I, alien ideologies gripped men's minds in the working class movement. And with the working class movement, a new sense of identification came to the American black. A black character said, I ain't a problem, I'm a person. And that person turned out to be the seeker of the realities of the American dream. In 1917, when he was called upon to protect that dream with his blood, he asked questions and demanded answers. Whose dream was he protecting? There followed the usual promises by the politicians, then the actual fighting and the dying, then peace. In 1919, the promises unfulfilled, riots rocked the nation's capital in Chicago, Pennsylvania, and St. Louis. Protests became a way of life. Black writers found an outlet for their grievances in the pages of Crisis, a monthly magazine published by the NAACP and edited by W.E.B. Du Bois. Its columns preach protest and revolt. Du Bois and his constituents fought a losing battle for equal rights. Although blacks were slowly rising out of their debased physical conditions, the black ghettos were growing ever larger. Instead of lessening, racial segregation spread until Jim Crow institutions and the black belt became commonplace. Once James Weldon Johnson, a conservative black poet, had been content to write with humility and supplication. In 1900, with the approval of Booker T. Washington, he wrote, Lift Every Voice and Sing, which was later to become known as the Negro National Anthem. But by 1917, Johnson's supplication had turned to bitter words. Then should we speak but servile words, or shall we hang our heads in shame? Stand back of new-come foreign hordes and fear our heritage to claim. No, stand erect and without fear, and for our foes, let this suffice. We've brought a rightful kinship here, and we have more than paid the price. James Weldon Johnson understood well the dilemma of the black author who had the problem of the double audience. His audience was both white and black America. To who should the black writer address himself? White people refused to look closely at the abominable treatment of blacks. They did not wish to accept the fact that slavery and segregation, the lynchings and murders, were a peculiarly unchristian way for a Christian nation to behave. Whites did not want any black writer holding up a mirror for them to see their true selves in. The white audience, although ignorant of the black experience, demanded that the black writer lie about his experience. White playwrights defined black life in a way that enabled white audiences to feel superior to blacks. White audiences were willing to see blacks presented only in images that permitted white comfort. To complicate the matter, the black audience had a different set of demands for black writers. They did not object to a real black being shown in his own neighborhood on 7th Avenue or Beale Street or Central Avenue, but they objected to the same black being exposed on Broadway or before white eyes. The black audience wanted only a nice Negro to be shown to the white world, or a Negro being abused and oppressed by whites. And so the black writer had to write for these two very distinct audiences, give the whites the lighter side of black life, the idyllic, happy black man laughing and shuffling along, and for the black audience, give them a steady diet of stories praising the race, stories of lynchings and burnings, or of Negroes passing for white. The black writer also felt that winning a white audience was the only adequate test of his talent, that only the judgment of a white audience had meaning. Therefore, he felt it a kind of racial duty to attract the white audience. But he could not attract them if he honestly explored his black experiences. This dilemma, needless to say, drove many a black writer mad. After World War I, there was a flowering of black talent in Harlem known as the Negro Renaissance. The black writer discovered a new voice within himself and liked it. White writers who had been interpreting black life with an air of authority and a preponderance of error now looked to the black writer for their cues. Three men cast a guiding influence over this movement: W.E.B. Du Bois, James Weldon Johnson, and Alain Locke. Alain Locke, scholar, essayist, and poet, devoted most of his time to the interpretations of the new Negro literary movement. He edited the famous anthology, The New Negro, which was a milestone and guide to black literature and art in the mid-20s. One of the most powerful voices of the Renaissance was Langston Hughes. For over 45 years, he wrote with one central purpose: to explain and illuminate the Negro condition in America. In plain images, Hughes wrote not complaints and pleas, but statements and demand. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. And in a bitter, angry political mood, Langston sings, "Good morning, revolution. You're the best friend I ever had." In 1926, Langston Hughes wrote, "We younger Negro artists who create now intend to express our individual dark-skinned selves without fear or shame. If white people are pleased, we are glad. If they are not, it doesn't matter. We know we are beautiful and ugly too. We build our temples for tomorrow, strong as we know how, and we stand on top of the mountain, free within ourselves." Another leading light of the Renaissance was Claude McKay, who wrote Home to Harlem and Banjo, which became bestsellers in 1928 and 1929. They were expressions of the spirit and temper of the new Negro. His subject matter was often about Negro lowlife and the colored working class, and his material often shocked and offended the sensibilities of the more conservative blacks. The emotional tone for the Renaissance was set by Claude McKay's poem, If We Must Die, which is still a favorite today. "If we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious spot. while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, while making their mock in our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. Another important writer of the Renaissance was Jean Toomer, whose major work, Cain, was published in 1923. It has been reissued in paperback recently. The poetry and essays of Sterling Brown, the folk tales of Zora Neale Thurston, and the essays and stories of Honor Bond Tamps and others flowered during the Negro Renaissance, which was brought to an abrupt end by the stock market crash of 1929. The novels of the 30s continued with the themes of the race praise passing for white lynching tradition. And in 1939, a powerful first work appeared, Uncle Tom's Children, a collection of four novellas by Richard Wright. Each novella is a violent, brutal comment on being forced to live in ignorance, fear, and shame. In his novel, Native Son, Richard Wright jolted the American literary scene with his character, Bigger Thomas, a bitter, ghetto-condemned black man. Wright brought into American literature, in a radically new way, the feelings and the texture of the complex psychological tensions simmering in the black ghettos of urban America. Bigger Thomas is a literary archetype of the hemmed-in, frustrated, and rejected black American who was propelled into violence by overwhelming conditions. One thought pervaded all of Wright's work, that the perennial human failing, man's gross inhumanity to man, had to be abolished. Richard Wright's message was addressed to a white audience, and his mission was to bring awareness to that audience and thus save the world. Native Son was a protest book, and Richard Wright was spiritual godfather to the next generation of black writers. This protest novel was a thing in the 40s. Chester Himes published If He Hollers, Let Him Go. Ann Petrie wrote The Street. Blood on the Forge appeared in 1941 and Whiteface in 1943. They all had a message of protest against America's treatment of its black minority. And the poets wrote in a similar vein, dealing with the fight against segregation and discrimination at home and in the armed forces. In 1950, Gwendolyn Brooks became the first black poet in the United States to win the Pulitzer Prize for her second volume of poetry, Annie Allen. She has published several volumes of poetry, a short novel, and volumes of verses for children. When asked, "Has much of your poetry a racial element?" she answered, "Yes. It is my privilege to present Negroes, not as curios, but as people." Up to 1950, the protest tradition was in full bloom, but then the black writer shifted his emphasis from protest to the problems and conflicts within the black group itself. In 1952, Ralph Ellison's novel, Invisible Man, won the National Book Award. The distinguishing quality of Ellison's work is its idealism. "Our strength," he says, "is that with the total society saying to us, no, no, we continue to move toward our goal." In 1954, James Baldwin's Go Tell It on the Mountain was published, followed by Giovanni's Room, Another Country, Tell Me How Long, The Train's Been Gone, and two plays. Baldwin is concerned with the alienation of oneself from one's people, which is the sum of the American experience. In the work of both Ellison and Baldwin, the black American's color, his identity, his invisibility are used poetically and symbolically to communicate the dilemma of all men who are denied dignity and purpose in the contemporary world. Each of these black writers we have been discussing faced a dilemma, and each of them had to make their decisions. Dunbar chose drink, Richard Wright and Chester Himes went to Paris to think it over, as did James Baldwin. Jean Toomer disappeared. Frank Yarby took the position that an unread writer is no writer at all. He chose entertainment over literature. His book, The Foxes of Harrow, became the first successful non-Negro novel by a Black American writer. When Richard Wright died in 1960, a new generation of Black writers, partly influenced by him and by James Baldwin, was beginning to explore the full range of Black American humanity. The short stories and novels of such writers as Melvin Kelly, Paul Marshall, John Oliver Killens, John A. Williams, questioned and challenged all previous interpretations of Black life in America. During this modern era, the rise of anti-colonialism throughout the world influenced Black writers. A movement developed towards self-definition, self-determination, and liberation. Those peoples whose institutions had been controlled by the white Western world were demanding autonomy rather than assimilation. After the death of Martin Luther King, the movement which began as a struggle to be integrated into the American mainstream became a struggle for the power of self-definition and self-determination and to make America ready for the coming of Black men. And so we enter the 1970s. The list of Black writers swells. John Oliver Killens, Elbridge Cleaver, Maya Angelou, Sam Greenlee. There is a Black theater with its emphasis on art, not for art's sake, but for the people's sake. There was Charles Gordon winning a Pulitzer Prize for his off-Broadway play, No Place to Be Somebody. And there is a new crop of Black poets creating a new language and a new aesthetic. In 1937, Richard Wright wrote an essay which foreshadows what the Black revolutionary writers such as Leroy Jones, who's now called Mayor Baraka, are saying today. Richard Wright said in 1937, "The Negro writer is called upon to create values by which their race is to struggle, live, and die. They are being called upon to furnish moral sanctions for action, to give a meaning to blighted lives, and to supply motives for mass movements for millions of people and make articulate the experiences of man. Every short story, novel, poem, and play should carry within its lines, implied or explicit, a sense of the oppression of Black people, the danger of war, of fascism, of the threatened destruction of culture and civilization, and the faith and necessity to build a new world." That's the end of that brief capsule of Black writing. We have a few minutes left, and I can tell you something about my own book if you care to hear it, or we can have some answers and questions, questions and answers. You had your hand up a little while ago. Tell you about my book. Well, the name of my book is Daddy Was a Number Runner. Has anybody in here read it? Oh, wow, we can have a discussion on that. Does anybody have any questions to ask me about my book?
What inspired you to write
it? Well, my own life experience inspired me to write it. My father was a number runner, and I was that little girl running around in Harlem in the 30s. You had your hand up while I was talking. You got half of them? Okay, I'll give you the others after class. There's seven, which are still pretty much in vogue today. Somebody have some questions on any of the material or on the book or about me or about anything? Yes. Yes, I'm working on a book about contemporary Black women. It'll take about cover about 20 years in the lives of about three Black women in Los Angeles. When I was in Los Angeles, I wrote a book about Harlem, so now that I'm in Harlem, I'm writing a book about Los Angeles. Logic to it somewhere, I guess. Yes, it's a novel. But of course, all novels are based on real people, you know. It's quite difficult at times because you want to have some friends left when you get through writing a novel, so you've got to take people and put two or three of them together and change certain facts. People can't recognize themselves, you know. Yes. Well, I wrote that. It took me quite a long time because I didn't write it steadily. In 1960, I made a resolution to work on my novel, and it was finally published in 1970. But in between that, I did other things. When I really stopped working and wrote full time, it took me about 3 years. Yes?
I was reading the biographical sketches I took, and I was wondering if you could tell us whether or how much influence on your craft your various professional experiences.
All right, I work for a black newspaper in Los Angeles for 3 years, and I think that that was very, very helpful. For anybody who wants to be a writer, any kind of writing is good because it requires discipline, and working for a newspaper, you have got to produce a certain amount and produce it very fast, so you become very disciplined at writing. I found that to be very helpful. I think the most helpful thing that I can say to anybody who wants to be a writer is to try, if possible, to spend your time writing. You know, I had to work most of the time and write early in the morning or late at night. And I think if you can somehow manage to starve a little more and write as a full-time job rather than, you know, putting your writing on after work, you'll find that you'll do it much better. I actually messed around with that book, as I say, for 10 years, but when I finally quit my job and collected unemployment and wrote on it steadily for 2 years, I was able to finish it. So it does require this type of concentration, and that's the best advice I can give to anybody. Like, don't go and decide you're going to be a teacher and write in the summer because it ain't going to work that way. You know, you need to give it more than that. Yes? Oh, that's a very good question. Well, for one thing, I was hampered. I'm very glad, and these days I think that the young people have more opportunity than we had when I was coming out of college. For example, I was a secretary before I went to college, and I was a secretary because I felt that I was never going to get to college. So when I was in high school, I had to, you know, come out of high school and go to work. So I took shorthand and typing so that I could do this. And after I worked 4 years, I decided to go back to school. And then when I finished college, I was still a secretary. There were so many jobs that are related to writing, which are open to blacks today that weren't then, like editors with book companies, writing for newspapers, you know. The only job you could get then was with a black newspaper, and how many people can be absorbed by a weekly newspaper. There are jobs now that I didn't even know existed, that young kids like you can come out of school and get jobs in publishing, working for New York Times, in related media, radio, television, where you can learn whatever craft it is that you want to learn that were not available to us then. So it was a distinct handicap being a writer. And as I mentioned in the paper, you had to, in those days, write what the white publishers wanted you to write or you would not be published. I don't think that is the case today. You have more freedom, more latitude in your subject matter today. All of these things were a handicap, you know. One of the positive things about it, is that I never really got hung up in the pulp feel. I never liked it. True Confessions and Love Story and the stories that appeared, say, in Saturday Review of Literature, you know. And never having got hung up in that, I was free to develop myself to write what I wanted to write. I always wrote what I wanted to write and remained unpublished for a good many years until history caught up with me, you see. Then it became popular to write the black novel. When it became popular to write the black novel, fortunately, my novel was about ready, so I could capitalize on it. But it's checks and balances as to, you know, how much disadvantage you have and how much advantage that you have.
Are you more inclined to write something on about black life?
I am inclined to write what I know, and I know about black life, so that's what I write. I have no desire to write about white life. It may be one day, 20 or 30 years from now, when I have completely explored my own black experience, I may be inclined to write about something, but I don't see that possibility because there's so much to write about. We have been really underwritten from our own point of view. And we all are human beings, and the best way to understand the other guy is to understand yourself, you know. If I stick myself with a pin, I'll bleed. The next guy will bleed too. So there is a humanity about us that is the same. This was very interesting when I was writing my book. I was living in Los Angeles, and as I was writing it, I was reading it to various people. Excerpts of it were published. And I read it to a couple of groups that I was involved in that had a number of white people in it. And I was amazed at their response to it because they could identify with so much of it completely. I was talking about people who were poor, and many of them had been poor, and they remembered their days of poverty. I was talking about young girls being molested by men. This knows no color, you know. And so much it's in the book is things that happen to human beings besides the specifics that happen to black people in Harlem. But there is a universality in writing about human beings, in writing about human nature, and other people can respond to it the same way we respond to Shakespeare or anything else, you see. Yes. I beg your pardon? I don't write too much poetry. And the funniest thing is the first thing I ever had published was a poem that I wrote. I was so taken with Native Son. I wrote a poem to Bigger way back when the book first came out, and it was published in the Harlem Writers Quarterly. And I have a poem that's been published in Présence Africaine, but I don't write too much poetry. I mostly write short stories. I have a short story that my latest short story will be coming out this month in Black Review number 2. I write short stories and articles mostly, and novels. I've written 3 children's books for the kindergarten set, the kindergarten to third grade, and they are black biographies because particularly for that age level, we don't have too many books for black kids to cut their teeth on. And also because black history is still, we still don't know black history. You know, I love black history and I write it and I'm learning it one step ahead of the people who are reading it. So I've written 3 children's books. They are picture books for the kindergarten to third grade. The first one has already been published. It's called The Freedom Ship of Robert Smalls. And how many of you in here has ever heard of Robert Smalls? You should have read my book when you was 5 years old and you'd know. Robert Smalls was a slave, and during the Civil War, he and 5 other slaves hijacked a Confederate gunboat called the Planter. They put their wives and their children on it, and they sailed the Planter past 3 Confederate forts and delivered it to the Northern Fleet, which was stationed right outside of harbor. And for this tremendous feat, these men were given their freedom, and Robert Smalls became a captain for the North during the Civil War, and he was captain of the Planter, the very ship that he hijacked. That's Robert Smalls. After the war, he went to Congress as a representative from Charleston. And you see, this is black history, the part of black history that was left out of the textbooks. The second book I wrote, which will be coming out this year, is on the life of Dr. Daniel Hale Williams. Has anybody heard of Dr. Williams? Okay. Dr. Williams was a black doctor, and in 1890s, he performed the first successful heart operation. So all heart operations and transplants come from Dr. Daniel Hale Williams. At that time there were no hospitals that would train black nurses, and there were no hospitals in the North where black doctors could practice. So he established the hospital, Freedman's Hospital in Chicago, which trained black nurses and black doctors. He has been called the father of black hospitals. but his main contribution to the world was the first successful heart operation way back there in the 1890s. And my third children's book, I'm sure you all have heard of Rosa Parks. How many have heard of Rosa Parks? Yeah. Okay, Rosa Parks, for those of you who have not heard of her, was the young lady in Montgomery, Alabama, who refused to sit in the back of the bus, and they hauled her off to jail, and that gave rise to the Montgomery bus boycott, which was headed by Dr. Martin Luther King, and that was the beginning of the so-called Black Revolt. That is Rosa Parks, who's still alive and who lives in Detroit. So I felt that there was a need for these types of biographies for the youngsters so that they could begin to learn Black history right from the cradle. I don't know how I got onto that. Some question you asked me. Oh, ask me about poetry. Yeah, well, so that's the type of thing I'm interested in. I think the class is almost up. I know you have to get your papers. What does it say? Is it 8:45? Is that when your class is over? And you have to get your names on all of those papers. So thank you. Wait a minute. Yes? There's been a lot of talk about it, and nothing has been signed yet, but eventually I think it will become a screenplay. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. You can find out more about the Yukon Archives and Special Collections at Yukon Archives on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes or listen online at WHUS.org. Our theme song is Dream in Casio Tone by Arable Lands, graphic design by Melica Bloom. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.